I've got with me down the line in Sydney, Maz Compton, who is gone from TRL, MTV, VJ, to radio, personality, to author, to all sorts of other creative, to gym owner, to God knows what else you're doing with your life that you haven't told me about. How are you, beautiful?
I'm so good, Jez. That's such an interesting introduction because it makes me sound like I'm really cool.
Yeah, well, that's what we've got to do. We've got to make each other feel cool.
All that stuff happens. Like, I've jammed a lot into 38 years on the planet.
And it's all been a journey. It's all in your book, The Social Rebellion, which I absolutely love because it's like, it's basically a guide to going alcohol-free and just by trying the first month. I've basically done that by experimenting myself, not by a particular guide, because I found that alcohol wasn't really serving me. It wasn't making me feel good. And you're an expert in all of this and the science of why that is happening and why people are drawn to it and all that stuff. So I'd love to really delve into why you did it to begin with. Like, what was your feeling around alcohol and it's your relationship with it?
It was actually really similar to what you just articulated, Jez. It was in 2014, I was living an oxymoron. So on paper, my life was so on point. I had a great national drive show. I'm pretty sure you and I hung out a lot and drank at bars and parties.
And
yeah, we did. So I was in this, you know, great season in my career. I just met this awesome guy and he was living in Sydney, so we were long distance dating, so I was falling in love and I just, everything on paper was coming up Maz Compton, but I realized towards the end of that year that I was doing this behavior every day that wasn't serving me, and that was drinking alcohol. So alcohol for me was something that I didn't really identify with having an issue with until I just really thought about it. And the alarming moment was when I thought to myself, you know what, I really don't want to go and drink this weekend, but I have to, because one of my friends is turning 30. Another one of my friends is visiting from Sydney. There's that work crew catch up on Sunday at lunchtime, and I know that that will go well into the evening. And when you say statements like that, like, I can't not drink, that for me was a really big red flag. And I think that that was one of the catalyst moments where I went, I probably need to get my alcohol consumption in check. And so I started exploring how to do that. So initially, I just felt a little bit uncomfortable with my relationship with alcohol. But I wasn't, you know, at rock bottom. I wasn't falling down, you know, after work. I wasn't missing work. I never drove my car when I was drunk. Like, I did not tick all of those boxes that we associate with somebody that might have alcohol dependency disorder or be referred to as alcoholic. I was the opposite of that. I was killing it in life. But internally, I now realize I was unable to deal with the emotional pressure and stress that had accumulated in my life after a series of pretty traumatic events. But I only know that now because I've been on the journey. I did not realize that at the time.
So, I mean, like, I think a lot of people can relate to that because it's something that is so embedded in our cultural norm and on the narrative that we don't really ever stop to think if it's good. Because it just comes part of the parcel of socializing, really. And that's why I love the book's title, The Social Rebellion, because the challenge, I think, comes, as you would probably know as well, when you just don't want to drink, or maybe even just dial it back to begin with by just having one drink tonight, if it's a real challenge mentally and socially, because we're social creatures and it's in our biology that we're, you feel like we're going to get rejected by the pack, or that, you know, it'll be a deep-seated fear of death, really, the social rejection.
It is so... I remember in late 2014 thinking it would be impossible for me to live a month of my life without drinking. Like, actual impossibility. And I think that, to me now, is such a foreign concept because I believe anything is possible now. But again, it's only because I went on the journey. And you're right, it is so ingrained in our culture. And one of my biggest fears was and I think everyone, one of everybody's biggest fears is rejection, because we're hardwired for connection and we don't like it when people don't like our Instagram posts, and we don't like it when people don't share things that we care about because it makes us feel good. And so, you know, the social validation that you get by doing what everyone else is doing is ingrained in our nature. So that's why I called it the rebellion, because I'm like, I have to do the rebellious act and not drink, and then I have to be so okay with that choice regardless of the outcome, because I need to do something good for me because I am suffering here. And that's what it really came down to. And as much as I had great friends, I didn't expect anybody to understand that, and most people didn't. But I had to put my health and well-being as a higher priority than other people's opinions, and that's a really difficult thing to do.
And so was there an actual pivotal moment where you, because you flicked the switch and just stopped cold turkey almost, you called us, so to speak?
Well, the pivotal moment of realising that I needed to do something, because what was happening is I was doing the same behaviour. So I was hanging out with the same friends, you know, doing this really high pressure job, and the one thing I could change was my relationship with alcohol. I didn't want to quit my job because I loved my job and I really enjoyed hanging out with my friends. I had to redefine something in order to get a different result, because if nothing changes, nothing changes. So I knew I was already there mentally. I was like, okay, I need to shift something up in my life in order to get a different result. And then on the 5th of September, a really good friend of mine, my manager at the time, Mark Byrne, suddenly died of a heart attack. And when you suffer a great loss and go through a really tragic event, I think it's just natural that you take a big look in the mirror. And Mark's death really woke me up to what I wanted to do on this planet, because I don't know how long I'm going to be here for, so let's make it worthwhile. So I went on a journey to grieve with the death of my friend, and through that journey in those next 2 months, I came up with a plan, and the plan was, let's take January 2015 off alcohol and see how that benefits my life. And during that month, every time somebody would offer me a drink, I said, no, I'm good, thanks. And I would think about Mark and making him proud. So for me, it was this really beautiful way of like positively grieving for my friend and actually processing that grief, rather than going the other way, which would have been neck a bottle of wine to cope with the grief that I was feeling. So I dealt with the issue. I honoured my friend's life. And then halfway through that month, or maybe it was day 21, I think, something switched in me, and I then started to not drink for me. And I have not had a drink for 3.5 years, because the benefit that I received, and it gets better, like year on year, month on month, it blows my mind how much better life is without alcohol for me personally, that I just probably won't ever drink again. Because I don't want to stop whatever's going on. Like, whatever I'm putting out in the universe is really great for me right now. So I'm like, I don't want to change that. So I'll just keep going with that. So initially, there was a really traumatic event in my life, and that, I think it pushed me, like it just backed me into this corner where I went, it's going to go one of two ways. You're going to end up losing it, or you can embrace it and deal with it. And I chose to deal with it. And then the way in which I dealt with it really was the bones for the social rebellion 3 and a bit years later.
I love how you detail the positive steps to what alcohol-free life is. And there are so many. And clearly, from the way you speak now, you can just see the tone in your voice and your happiness. And like, it's too good to not compromise now. Like, your nervous system is stronger. Your whole body is more glowing. You feel more on purpose. You feel more capable, more energy. And I don't know, I think just applaud you on that shift of digging into the pain, or pushing into the pain. Because I think that's, and having a mechanic, I suppose, where you could serve your higher self with your, you know, a real dear friend Mark's passing. So it's a beautiful and powerful thing you did, I think. And real, It's super admirable because I think it is so easy to just do the opposite. Like the easier thing is to just drown out. And this is a more of a spiritual thing. It's more like anytime something traumatic or any kind of suffering happens. I think I'm exploring that a lot at the moment in myself, like the purpose of darkness or the purpose of pain. Like, not to get too biblical, but the Lord said, and I'm not Christian, I think it's true, basically the creator of everything or everything said that I created all the darkness and all the light. So it's kind of to neglect the darkness and think of it as other and bad and evil or not good for us is truly ignorant of a more expanded state of consciousness, of which is embracing it. And what's the learning? It's the teacher. You know, it shows us our weak points, or it shows us how we can grow and how we can evolve. And if we didn't have that mechanic in nature, we wouldn't actually probably be able to evolve.
It's true. And I think, I mean, further to that point, I think unless there is darkness, there is no light, because you can't, if it's all light, you don't know, because it's all light. So the darkness creates the light. And I was having, I catch up with my mum a lot. We're very, very close. And we used to catch up for afternoon wines, and now we have tea. And we had a tea the other day, and it's really actually quite cute. So she's read The Social Rebellion, and I asked her to read it before I published it. And she said no. She's like, because she's my mum and she's like 100 years old. She was like, I can't read it on my screen. I have to have the physical book. I'm like, oh, mum. So anyway, so when I got the first print run done, I gave mum a copy of the book so she could hold it in her hot little hand and read it. And so she's finished reading it, and we were having a chat, and she said, you know what, Maz? She goes, I remember those days when you were in Adelaide and in Melbourne, and you were, you know, living away from here, and you were going through so much and your job was so intense. And she goes, I just used to pray for you all the time that you would just be able to manage with all the pressure in your chosen career, like all the self-pressure I put on myself, but also like I chose that path. I don't regret it at all. I'm so glad I worked in media for 12 years. And she goes, but had you not have stepped through all of that, where would we be today? She's like, you would not be able to turn around and help people, because your story would have no merit or worth, because you have been the broken person at the beginning of that journey, and now look at what it's turned into. And it was just such a nice way, I think, to acknowledge the dark seasons in my life and the times that I really struggled and I battled with a dependency, that it is possible to not only just get a handle on that and be good with that, but then to use that story to help other people. And that's what I love about the position I'm in now, is just to be able to go, guys, I did this wild and crazy thing. It's called stop drinking alcohol. And it's totally doable, because I do it every day, and it will make you a better human being. Why don't you give it a go? And here are the steps that I used. And I just love the evolution of, you know, of my story from darkness into light, and then sharing the light. I think that's the next step, is to then, you know, out of that, let it be a gift to others.
That's the service thing, or the guru who finds enlightenment in the mountains. What use is that wisdom and embodiment of total all-seeingness unless it's given to? I think that's such a natural next step, is to give it back to people. And the tricky with that is, and I'm sure you find this, and I'd be interested in what your thoughts on it, is like how you do it in a way that's not preachy, essentially. How you do it in a way that's like embraces their humanity, you know, and isn't talking to them. And I think you've done that lovely in the book, but has that been a challenge in yourself?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's great that I've gone through this amazing transformation. But really, no one else cares that much, I think. Everyone's just concerned with their own stuff. And so that's why the 31 days for me is my offering, because I've gone through this epic life transformation, and that is a win for me, it's a win for my family, and it's a win for the people in my circle. But you've got to experience it for yourself. And so the way that it becomes manageable, I think, and achievable for people, is to go, just give it a try and see how you go. Because I know how much I changed in four short weeks, I felt, Jez, I actually felt like I had been given a new brain after 31 days of not drinking alcohol. It was like, it wasn't just, it was more than my eyes became open. It was like I got a brain transplant and I was able to think clearly for the first time in 20 years. Like, that is how revolutionary it was for me. And I don't know if that's a direct... I don't know if it's a direct result of how much alcohol I was drinking. I mean, it could... like, there's that as well. I'm like, maybe someone who just has a couple of cheeky glasses of wine during the week, like, they'll get to the end of the 31 days and go, now I feel the same. But, but yeah, I think, you know, you've got to... life is... you've got to go out and experience it. And so I would say to people who are scared, because I was so scared, like... what is the worst that's going to happen if you don't drink for 4 weeks? Like, it's not, I'm not asking you to do home surgery on your leg that you could really balls up and have a leg amputated. Like, I'm just suggesting that you stop doing a behaviour that's having an adverse effect on your life for 4 weeks and see what it looks like. And so for me, again, that's the achievable part because that's how my journey started. And it's also not about... well, I don't think anyway, it's necessarily about never, ever, ever drinking again, ever, ever. It's just about managing your relationship with alcohol because I don't think that alcohol is the issue. I think our relationship with it is. And I think our relationship with it is not great because it is the most addictive substance on earth. And it's very accessible. It's bonkers. It blows my mind. It actually blows my mind.
It's crazy that like someone like marijuana or plant medicines aren't actually, which actually the classic psychedelics are impossible to be addicted to and they have zero toxins in them and they actually heal your psyche and allow you to resolve things if facilitated in the correct setting. And obviously it's not for everyone as well. It's for those that, like alcohol is not for everyone. So it's someone like that, I don't know, just jumped into the psychedelic realm really quickly.
It's funny that you mentioned that though, because I've just been listening to, there's a Joe Rogan episode with Michael Pollan and they talk about psychedelics because Michael Pollan's new book is about it. And it really blew, because at first I was like, you what? Like you took what? And what happened? And how is that okay? But on doing a bit more research, I'm like, oh, it's just, it's a plant out of the forest, so it's out of the ground.
Yeah.
Surely that's okay. But yeah.
Straight out of the ground.
It's also like we have these, you know, we all have these biases that are just ingrained in us. And so in our society, it's actually fine to drink a bottle of wine with your friends when you're having a bad day, but it's not okay to shoot up heroin.
To find an actual resolution.
Or, yeah, or to maybe go to a therapist and process your emotions like you have the capacity to do. So that becomes the big societal struggle because it's... and I used to do this too. If I'd had a good day, I'd have a drink. Bad day, drink. Friend had a bad day, come over, let's have wine. Like, it was every solution I ever came up with was the one solution, let's drink alcohol. But it doesn't change the circumstance or the problem. So alcohol just stops your brain working.
So it gives you a little moment of escapism, right? That's what it's given us, a moment of we don't have to worry about our things. We can get some distance from our things.
Correct. And the way that... and look, Jez, I'm not a scientist at all. So please, anyone listening who thinks I'm a scientist, this is not scientific fact. This is just my little opinion. But... what I think happens is, so let's use an example, like you've had a really long week and you're really stressed out and you want to have a drink to take the edge off and to relax you. I think that's a very, very common situation on a Friday afternoon. So you're feeling exhausted, maybe stressed, and you just want to relax, take the edge off, so you have a glass of wine. When that alcohol goes into your system, it changes the neural pathways in your brain. So what actually happens is your brain stops connecting with your body, so that gives you a feeling of relaxation. But it's actually causing more stress in your body because your brain is not working at its optimum capacity. You don't actually get relaxed. You cause more stress in your body, but because your brain is just checked out and is not feeling what your body is going through, you feel relaxed. So the real effect of alcohol is the next day when you feel like utter ass and you're dehydrated and you've got the worst hangover and it's awful. That's the actual effect of alcohol. It's not that instantaneous, your brain's not working for a few minutes. Or maybe a few hours, depending on how many tables you danced on. I don't know. But I don't behave that way after drinking three soda waters.
And how funny is it when you are sober and you see people shit-faced? It's prehistoric. And happily judging here because it is what it is. Also, when you went through that kind of this journey, as we talk about, like how everyone's got their individual journey of essentially really awakening or self-realization or coming home to source or whatever you want to call it. And as you did that and as you, in those like 3 years ago when you kind of got serious, I suppose, about committing to yourself like that, what kind of things, did you find any things just unearthed that you like little demons, not demons, but you know, like darkness or bad habits or things? Because as you start to awaken, I find more and more shit just coming to the surface.
Yeah, I do. So the in the 31-day kind of blueprint that I've written in the book, I think it's maybe on like day 8 or something. So just to explain that, each day of the 31 days, there's like a little kind of, there's just a bit of a like, hey, read this kind of thing to set you up for your day. And then every day there's a daily mission, which is like a practical thing that you do, because when you have a thought and you marry it with a physical action, it will actually get imprinted in your body. And then there's like a little daily mantra. So
is it Dizzy, day 8's Dizzy Rascal quote? And then the daily shot is listen to your inner voice rather than your everyone else's?
Well, one of them, so the daily mission around there is to go and buy a box of tissues. And the reason, or maybe it's day 2, the reason I explain to people that you might need a box of tissues is because when you stop drinking alcohol, and it takes about 48 hours to 72 hours for all the ethanol to get out of your liver, or for your liver to pump it out of your body. So 3 days in, you are then, you've gone through the worst physical part of the detox. Then the rest is just, it's just your brain catching up. So the rest is just mental. But I found I was really emotional. So I was just, all these feelings came up. Like, it was stupid. I'm like, I'm crying on the bus. But I'm not, I wasn't sad. Like, I wasn't sad. It's not like I'd have a bad day and then I'd just be a hysterical emotional wreck. Like, I just
needed a cocktail.
I would go to get a coffee and sit by the beach and just, tears would just explode out of my face. I'm like, what is going on? And what I realized is that is just the emotion that I was suppressing for years and years, and it just compounded, and then trauma and pressure and distress and life and disappointment and failure and all those things I never dealt with. I just used alcohol to cope with. So when you are coping with something, you cannot get resolve and you cannot move your life forward. So what happened in the 31 days for me is I actually dealt with a lot of stuff that I had been suppressing. So I just let the emotions come out, and I also, which I think is really important for every human being on the planet, is I went to a therapist. And I still see Frankie. She's amazing because she helps me articulate. Like, sometimes I would go to, and I don't mean every day. Like, I go once a month. I see her now. But at the time, I was seeing her maybe once or twice a week because there was a lot of stuff coming up, and I needed an expert to help me understand what was happening in my emotional life. And I think, like, people talk about, you know, fitness, people talk about your sex life. I think our emotional life is a legitimate part of our lives that we have not been given the tools to manage effectively. And so we just go and find something that will stop it all from happening because it's too much. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know why. I just went on a random tangent. Oh, you get emotional. I cried so much. No, it was just because all this stuff came up. And so I don't know that that's necessarily a super, like, I don't know anyone listening to this that would be like, oh, cool, I want to get super emotional on the beeline when I'm on my way to work. I'm going to stop drinking. So that's, you know, that was one of the things that was, it happened and I wasn't expecting it to happen. But just the, my, my level of self-awareness increased dramatically because I wasn't constantly worrying about, oh God, what did I do last night? Or what will people think of me if I don't drink? Or what do people think of me because I drink all the time? So I stopped caring. I didn't stop caring about humans. I stopped caring about their opinions and having that affect me. So I became more... It's so funny. As I said this, I just sat up straighter in my chair because that's what I feel like. If there was a physical way to explain those first 31 days for me, I just... became self-aware enough to go, you know what, I think I'm going to be good, and I haven't been good, and I've been irresponsible with dealing with my stuff and my life stuff and my choices, so I'm going to take responsibility for that. And that level of empowerment, that's why I kind of call the book self-empowerment, because that level of empowerment, you can't really articulate it to anyone until they go through that motion and that moment where they go, okay, I'm starting to feel really good. I feel really strong. I feel independent. I don't think I need things anymore. I don't need to appease that person. I don't need to be attached to a career. I don't need to have my business card, you know, and my identity all mixed in together. You just get this ridiculous sense of clarity where I'm like, where was this train of thought 10 years ago? Like, where was my brain? Where has it been? But when you get it back, you just don't want to lose it again, you know? It's such a gift. It's like the rebirth.
It's so funny. And, I mean, I can relate to all those things and the process as well, and actually being shit-faced a lot and all that kind of stuff. And for you, did you find a new social click, or, you know, what's your – I love the empowerment thing that you're saying for starts as well, like how you – you're taking responsibility for the energies that you absorb, your emotions, the way people affect you, the things that you go through life. You're owning them and saying, right, this is my responsibility now. It's in my body and I need to process it and deal with it and resolve it for the better of myself and then for the better of everyone else. So you're like, essentially you're purifying yourself or resolving karma or like cause and effect energy. And so no wonder you stood up tall, because it's like absolute empowerment. That's so cool. I love the way you said that.
Thanks. Yeah, I could talk about this forever. I'm just like, because as we're talking, I'm just going through like, you know, I've had these really cool little milestone checkpoints in 3.5 years, and I'm like, man, I probably need to write another book.
Great. Well, I'd love to see another one.
But yeah, let's get people started on the journey first. I think, you know, that one step at a time, right?
I think it's just such an important thing in our society in general is to take responsibility for ourselves, because I think when we denounce responsibility or sever this connection with our body, mostly, I think that it is like our body's telling us something. I'm exhausted. I've got trauma I need to resolve. Well, you know, like that's one thing I've noticed the thread in all these pursuits of like meaning, I guess, is that taking responsibility and listening to our body is much harder to do, because it doesn't feel that good. And like you say, all that emotional shit comes up. But if we didn't have, we just need to kind of parent ourselves into a place where we can do it safely and just look after ourselves during that time, or ask a friend to do that kind of thing, because it is hard. It's super hard. And that's the thing, in a lot of ancient cultures, they had these ceremonies or these processes or these coming of age things where they truly resolved, you know, awoken to their power, resolved their traumas. Like there's plenty of therapies and processes like that, and it's just not in our culture, or it's getting less and less stigmatized, I think. But
it's definitely not in our culture. And I think our society is not set up to see us flourish. That's what that's my casual observation. You look at the food industry and you look at the way in which social media has taken over, and they have very little benefit to us as thriving, excellent, empowered humans. But I truly believe that everyone has the capacity to deal with the choices that they've made without, you know, added anything, without added sugar, without added anything to make us feel okay about the dumb choice that we made. And then it's about learning to make better choices. And that's, again, another sort of offshoot of the social rebellion is I want people to make great choices and be good with them. And I made so many dumb choices for so long because I didn't know any better. But when you know better, you do better. So I'm like, okay, let's get the education out there. And I really believe, because I know now, I have the capacity to deal with anything that gets thrown my way, good, bad, or indifferent. I have the capacity to resolve it and deal with it very well. And I'll give you an example. So I quit drinking on the 1st of January 2015 and I just started the Sydney Breakfast Show that year. So I did a year of breakfast radio in a very intense, volatile breakfast market with a lot of pressure. And on the 6th of October, I was told that I was fired. Now, that was one of the most devastating phone calls I've had. Did I go to the bar and smash a few vinos? Nope. Did I want to? Hell yeah, I totally did. I was like, well, what else do you do when you get fired from, you know, fired from a show and it's all in the newspaper and you're publicly humiliated and the career that you've wanted for so long that finally happened after so much hard work just got snatched away? Like, what else do you do? But I didn't. And I went through that whole thing and I did not rely on alcohol to get me through it. And I have come out the other side stronger, better, and so grateful that that happened on that day, because look at the result. The social rebellion wouldn't exist if I was still hosting that show, for sure. I know that. And maybe I still wouldn't, maybe I wouldn't be drinking alcohol still, but I wouldn't have been able to articulate it and have the time to put it into a book and start a movement. So I know that my capacity, that was one of the moments too where I was like, geez, I'm getting really good at dealing with life, you know, like 10 months of not drinking and like massive curveball, and I'm actually great. And I'm not going to go and commiserate at the bar. And even when, I love my breakfast radio team. They were so awesome. But after our last show, we all went to, you know, you all go to the pub because what else do you ever do in radio other than go out for drinks and do radio? And we sort of had like our, you know, final last hurrah lunch. And I said to my boss, I was like, what time's the lunch / booze fest? And she said, it's at 12. And I said, I'll be there at 1. And I went to the gym. I'm such a nerd. I went to the gym and did a workout. I had a shower, made myself feel awesome. And I walked into that pub at 1 and I hung out with everyone until 6 and I drank soda water and everyone had a great time. But I was so in control of my choice and I was so fine to not drink. And that was the season 10 months in where I was like, I don't think I'll ever drink again. If I can go through something so brutal and come out the other side and happily, it wasn't like I was sitting at the pub going, damn it, I wish I could have a drink with everyone. I'm missing out. I was just sitting there going, I'm so empowered here. I'm so glad that I can interact with everyone and I don't have to have a drink to feel like I'm connecting with people. I can just sit here and be me and have genuine connection until the sun goes down and everyone loses their minds. And that's when I leave.
I mean, I want to go down so many avenues, but I'm just trying to pick one. So, but I'm going to dig into, if you don't mind, talking about the energy of media and the high-pressure environment of that, essentially why you were drawn to it and then also what you found out about it as you were deeply embedded in it.
Oh, wow, that is such a loaded question. Okay, so... why was I drawn to it? I'm just a massive attention seeker. But do you know what's funny? Okay, it's actually a bit funny. I've only just started unpacking this for myself. I went to a... Have you ever had a shiatsu massage?
A shiatsu? Is that Japanese?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have.
Okay. Well, I had a shiatsu massage... sesh with this kind of Rioja yoga.
Session sounds like it was like an eight-hour thing.
Yeah, it was. Can you imagine an eight-hour massage? That would be heaven.
Avery did that on the radio show.
How many hours did he have a massage for?
I think it was all day. It was like eight or nine hours.
Oh, I would probably get really bored, actually. Anyway, I digress. I went to a shiatsu massage therapist, and he is like a bit of a guru in Rioja yoga, which is a Japanese style of yoga, which I practice and I love. And he is just, you know, so with shiatsu, like you go there and you lie down on your back on like a mattress, and he just, well, this was my experience. He just sort of like looked at my limbs and like touched my wrists and my ankles and then didn't really do much else. And then he knelt down beside me and he's like, right, so your left, he goes, you see how your left foot slightly twists in? So when I'm sitting up with my legs straight on the ground, my left foot is like slightly pigeon-toed if my feet are relaxed.
Yeah.
And he goes, you see that? I'm like, yeah. And he goes, so that is the result. So you've got a twisted hip, and hips store sadness. And he goes, so I think you've had a childhood trauma. So, and I'm like,
wow.
What? I was just coming for a massage. Like, what the hell? And so he said, your body doesn't lie, and your body is your story. And he's like, so all of the stuff that has happened in your life is in your body, and I'm going to help you untwist your hip and rinse out that sadness from that childhood trauma. He goes, it doesn't even matter what it was. I'm like, I don't know what it was. I had a great childhood. and then another thing that came up is, he talked about my, I guess, self-doubt was why I was attracted to media, because I'm very driven. So he was sort of talking along the lines of, you, for some reason, have this, like, you don't believe how excellent you are, and you don't believe your own hype. And so you have sought out a medium that would give it to you externally because you can't generate it internally. So he goes, so that explains the whole, he goes, that explains the whole media thing. And I'm like, how did you just psychoanalyze me?
I just needed to get my pigeon toe fixed.
I know. I'm like, what the? Oh, it blew my mind. So since then, that was about a year ago. Since then, I have done a lot of journaling about why was I attracted to media? Why was I so good at it? You know, why did I love it so much, but it caused me so much anxiety, and there was so much pressure? Like, there were so many negatives during the journey, but when you're trying to seek outside validation, you don't process the internalized stress it's causing you. You just go for the, yeah, but like my face is on a billboard and I got to interview this celebrity and everyone's kind of a bit jealous of me in my life. So that feels good. So I'll keep doing that thing. So that's why I think I was attracted to media. What I learned throughout my entire journey in media was nothing about myself, because I've done the self-work since leaving. Because when you're in, I think, an industry that is 24/7, or 24/8, if that's even a thing. Like, what's more than 24/7? That's media. You don't ever have the space and the time to sit back and go, how am I going? Not did I do a great break on the radio, or did we nail that interview, or, you know, is that journalist going to publish an article to get our show name out there so that people will read that and then listen to our radio show and our ratings will go up and then we'll get paid more money. Like, all of these things your whole being is consumed by, and there's no room for you. So I, looking back now, I think it was the best way to distract myself from the self-work of finding true love for me. And because I didn't have any of that, and I can only acknowledge it now that I'm out of that game and I've gone on this, you know, wild journey of self-awareness and empowerment. But I think that one of the reasons why I was so great at it too is because I was trying to seek more and more validation and more acknowledgement from other people telling me that I was awesome, so that maybe I'd finally believe it. And
yeah, wow.
Yeah, and that, and it's funny because I got told a lot how awesome I was, and our show did really well, and I ended up in rooms and offices that blew my tiny mind. I was like, how the hell did I get here? It like felt like a massive imposter, but I just went with it. I'm like, I'll take it. I will do this for as long as I can, and for as long as, you know, I can service this part of my life. And then, I mean, it was a beautiful way that it happened, where I didn't choose to tap out. Like, I got benched. And so I was kind of forced to go on that journey of self, because I had the time, and I had to completely reconfigure how I thought about me. Because for 12 years, it was Maz the TV chick or Maz the radio chick. Like, it was never just Maz. It was just Maz the something. Or Maz the person that was on the morning show every week. Or Maz the entertainment reporter. Or, you know, Maz that went in the casino beef week queen pageant. All of the stupid things that we did in radio because you can, because it's awesome like that. And when I left media, I didn't have that dot, dot, dot. And that was really brutal and really tough for a little while, because I was like, who even am I now? And what I realized is I was doing my what in life. So what was I? Entertainment reporter, radio host, you know, some would say role model, some would say successful. They were all the what's in my life. And then when I left radio, I realized we have to find our why. And when you find your why, the what doesn't matter. So I was able to find my purpose after I left doing a job that I now can't tell you why I was doing, other than that I was great at it and I kept getting offered more money to do other jobs. And I kept saying yes. And that was that. So when I left, I went on this, I read this great book by Simon Sinek called Start With Why, and I managed to articulate my purpose in life. And I was like, wow, that feels much easier. I'll just do that now. and however that is expressed, so long as it's ticking the why box for me now, I'm really good for it. And if it doesn't tick the why box, I just say no. And I'm happy to say no to stuff that's not going to serve me serving my purpose.
Wow, that's so powerful, man, to have it down that clear and to surrender your identity. That's it. That's no small thing, you know. Like,
it was a huge thing. It was, and I remember my now husband. He was so supportive during that whole season when I was a bit of a mess for a little bit, probably because I wasn't getting blind to deal with the decision. But I remember saying to him, like, I'm like, who even am I? Like, I was just so angry. I'm like, who am I without radio? Like, who am I without this show? Who am I without my co-host? But all those things were the external validation that I needed for me to think that I was someone. And and he just went, I know who you are. He's like, I don't care what you do for a job. I just want you to be you, because I love you for you, not what you do. And it really... it was such a cool moment, because I remember my brain twisting and I'm like, so everyone else, not everyone, but a lot of people love me for what I do or for what I can do for them, but he loves me for who I am. And I didn't even know who I was in that moment. And he was like, it doesn't matter. We'll find her. We'll figure it out. And so having somebody that was just so on point with support and just genuine love was such I feel so, so incredibly honoured to do life with him, because he twisted my brain into this, like, this great place where I was able to go, okay, cool, I'm going to go find out who she is. What do I need to do? And then I, you know, start journaling and Googling, and I find books and I do research and I listen to podcasts, and I did the work, you know, and it was tough work, but great work to do.
So cool, man. It's such a powerful, powerful journey, because I think everyone can relate to that thing of being something that they see themselves reflected in the world as, or meet in expectations of, but surrender your identity like that is absolutely, like, I mean, that's what you do when you drop DMT. You're forced to. The only bad trips you have is when you try to cling on to your sense of localized awareness of what you are. And if you don't surrender, you have a traumatic experience. But if you surrender, it's the most enlightening, empowering, beautiful, all-seeing, all-knowing, all-experiencing, unity moment that you could ever have. And so you're actualizing that in a very, very, very real way in your integrated reality with your eyes awake.
Yeah, and it's scary too. Like, I remember, like, not... So then the following year after that season, the second year that I wasn't drinking, I was doing a weekend radio show. And then the year after that, I got offered, because we wrote out our contracts for a year on a weekend show. And I got offered a couple of jobs in radio, and it was so tempting to go back to the familiar. Because I was like, oh, cool, I can redeem myself here. I can get back in the game. Like, I might have to move to a different state to do it, but I can rebuild my brand as a radio personality, and I can, you know. And then I was like, hang on, no, we're moving forward here. Let's do the progression thing. Let's not regress back to the comfort zone of that is exactly the journey that I just figured out of I don't need to have a job title or a career to identify who I am and what I stand for. And here I am questioning whether or not I want to take a job in Canberra or whatever. Like, but I came to a really concrete decision. I was like, I'm 100% okay to turn down this job opportunity, and here are my reasons why. But the comfort of something that you've done for so long is really appealing, because I'm like, I could just slip right back in there and you know, do all the stuff that I was doing and just do that forever. But then it wasn't going to serve my why. So now everything has to come under that filter. So I think there are a lot of people who they do so much stuff, and if you ask them what they did, their list is like 10 pages long, you know. And if you ask them why, they go, what? I just do it because I have to, or I just do it because I've got a crazy $1 million mortgage because I bought a house in Sydney, or I have to because it's the family business, or I have to because everyone has to have a side hustle. Like, everyone has to, you have to have a full job, full-time job and a side hustle. If you don't have a side hustle, you're not working hard enough and you're not busy enough, you know? But if you ask anyone why, and that's my, I am that annoying person now. I ask people why all the time. And
that's a great question.
Oh, because we don't ask it enough, and it's one of the most unanswered questions when you go, what? So why are you doing that? Well, because I have to. Do you know you don't actually have to do anything? You are making a choice to do that. Did you realise that? Oh, that's a great argument to have. No, but I don't have a choice. No. 100% you have a choice. You don't. There's some things that you can't control. Like, I couldn't control the phone call from the radio boss is telling me that I didn't have a job anymore, but I 100% took responsibility for my response to that, and I decided to respond well. I could have been a massive jerk about that. I could have been really irresponsible and immature, and I could have reacted, but I chose to respond. And I just think these are the things that there's not enough conversation about, because I do believe if people just started figuring out their why, they would be less stressed, because they would probably let 90% of the things that they think they have to do just go by the wayside and focus on being a great human and a good parent and a great colleague, and there's going to be less drama and less trauma. And that's the place to start. And no one's really starting there. You know, like, I'm 38 and I've figured it out. I'm like, well, my 20s were a total mess because I had no sense of purpose.
But you feel, I'd love to know what your why is specifically, and what is there some crossover with it back then?
It keeps changing, actually. Like, so at the moment, just to paint a picture, I am sitting in, like, we've got this beautiful big long dining table that my husband built because he's a builder and a carpenter. And I'm sitting at that and I'm looking into our kitchen area, and on the fridge it says in big block letters, empowering people to be better humans. So that is my purpose. And that is the one that is articulated on the fridge at the moment. But it actually keeps evolving. So at the moment, it feels more like empowering and leading people to make great choices. So if something falls, so if somebody says to me, hey, do you want to come on this podcast? And I go, yeah, what's your podcast about? And they're like, oh, you know, puppies. I'm like, nah, is that going to empower or lead anyone to make a great choice? Probably not. I'll probably give that a miss. Although if it was a puppy-related podcast, I would go on that because I'm obsessed with puppies and I'm really dog clucky. So that was probably a bad example. But for the most part, it's got to serve my purpose. And so I just do the things that do that now. So I own two gyms and I really believe that we have created two great communities that empower people to make better choices about their health, their wellness, their nutrition choices, and their fitness. So that ticks that box. I wrote a book called The Social Rebellion. It's all about empowering people to redefine their relationship with alcohol. That totally ticks the box. I got asked to host a show on Channel 10, and I won't tell you what show it is, but it did not align with my purpose, and so I said no.
wild and pissed Friday nights out.
Because it wasn't even a question. I was like, that absolutely does not align with what I'm here to do. That's not my life work, so thanks for thinking of me, but I'll give that one a miss.
Man, it's fucking dope.
It makes it easy.
And the universe would just conspire.
Yeah, the universe conspires massively.
Because you're putting your hand up to be of service. You're putting your hand up. You know what you're about and you're a vessel for it to fill. So, like, there's a shitload of need for it. So all the need's going to pour in your way.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when – and because I've never really experienced this like I am experiencing it now. So when I was working in radio, I felt like I just kind of – I used to always say to people, well, accidentally nailing life. Like, I didn't feel like I had much control. I don't like the word control, but I didn't feel like I was entirely responsible for my level of success, because that really came down to the big bosses in the radio stations listening to my show and asking me to do bigger shows. So I wasn't really, like, I wasn't really facilitating that. I was just lucky. I mean, how many radio shows are there? And they just, like, picked ours, you know? It was a huge compliment. But I feel that now stuff happens and I'm like, wow, that's just beautiful, and I can't explain it, but I'm just going to go through that door that just opened, and it feels like it's because I'm just like this vessel. And it's like the way I speak about the Social Rebellion is I truly believe, since I named it the Social Rebellion, I gave life to it, and now I'm just facilitating where it goes. So it's not even me. It's not about necessarily me or my story or I did this thing and everyone should do this thing because look at me. It's actually not about – it's about everyone else that it can help. And now all I'm doing is taking calls and talking about it and just trying to spread this message where I really believe this thing that I did can help you and your friend and your mum and your sister. And so why don't you guys go and do that wonderful thing and let me know how it goes? That the doors that have opened without me even sneezing is I can't really articulate, because it is really overwhelming, just the opportunity. And that's not because I've worked for 24 hours in the day hustling. That's because I've just sat back and gone, I'm doing my life work now. Great.
So good. It's just inspiring and joyful to hear that that's exactly where you are in life.
It shouldn't be hard. Like, I see people struggle, and no judgment. Like, everyone's on their own journey. But I see so many people, like, exhausted and tired and burnt out, and they just look, like, depleted. And I'm like, oh, sweetheart, like, take the load off trying to tick all the boxes and just figure out your purpose and do that. Because I now, I don't work. I just get to do what I'm passionate about every day. That's my life. And so when people say, I find this hilarious too, Jez, when people are like, gee, you must be so busy with the Social Rebellion. I'm like, no, it's an absolute joy. And I've got really healthy boundaries around when I check my emails. Like, it's a total pleasure. I'm actually not busy. I'm the least busy I've probably been in my life, but my productivity is through the roof. Go, like, do the maths on that. That doesn't make any sense, but that's what's happening.
I'd love to know your boundaries, and I'd also love to know how you the process of finding one's purpose, or your what the one that you discovered was.
So boundaries, I think most people crave boundaries, but we're all rebellious, so we just hate them at the same time. So I actually am better with a routine. This is why I was great in radio as well, because I had to be on air at a certain time every day, and I had something to be accountable to. When you're an entrepreneur, it's a little bit different because it's, you know, there really isn't anything to be accountable to other than you just want to like get that bit of the work done. So I just have a daily routine where I get up at 5, I do, and this is pretty much every day. So I get up at 5, I do my yoga and meditation, I make breakfast.
Yummy.
I love it. I make breakfast for my husband, and then I get him out the door to work on the road, and then I'll sit down. I might go for a walk, depending on the day, or I'll sit down at my computer and I'll do a few hours of work, and then I go and I get out of the house. And if I'm doing meetings, it's usually in the afternoon. So I can just do my work in the morning, like as in emails and boring stuff, which is a part of running a business. And then I'll do meetings in the afternoon so that I feel like I'm social. Because another thing with being an entrepreneur, when you're the one CEO/founder of the business and there are no other employees, is you can get really bored and you can get really unmotivated. So I'm like, if I engage with human beings in the afternoon, it brings me up. It's like my little afternoon coffee fix. Even though I don't have a coffee, I get full from that. And then I don't do any work in the evenings. I just don't.
Right.
Because nothing's that urgent. Everyone can wait. And I'll get back to you when I've set my structure down for my morning. But it took me a really long time to figure that out, because for about 10 years I had a producer telling me what to do, when I needed to do it and where I needed to be. And I had to, like, learn to manage my own schedule. And that's a real skill in order to do it well.
So much fun.
And especially for creatives, oh, my gosh. It's because I get so distracted. I decided to delete my Gmail and my Facebook apps from my phone. So now when I'm out of the house, I cannot. Because I found myself just checking emails. I'd go for a walk with my phone in my pocket, and then I'd sit down and look at the view, and then whip out my phone and start looking at the emails. I'm like, what am I doing? This is so counterproductive. I'm meant to be here immersed in nature, filling up my soul cup, and I'm like looking at flipping invoices. What is going on? So I did that intentionally to give, again, that's putting a healthy constraint around my natural habit to distract myself from even a beautiful walk in nature. I manage to distract myself from, because that's just what I do naturally. So I've had to really, it's a discipline thing, but meditation and mindfulness has helped me massively. Just be present in my body and be okay to not do 400 million things today. Like, I try and give myself 2 things to do every day. It used to be about 200. Now I'm like 2. Probably got to like post that thing, and might want to call my friend Nikki, who I haven't spoken to for a month, and just see how she's going. They're my 2 things today. And that's it. Like today, it was chat with Jez. And then I'm going to see my sister-in-law this afternoon to hang out. That's it. That's all I'm doing. Don't need to keep, you know. And you know what? Like, at some point, like, I've got stepkids, so I'm like, we'll feed the kids at some point. They usually tell us when they're hungry, so it's fine. That's not an issue. there's food in the fridge. I'm really lucky that that's, you know, the position that we're in. And what else is there? It's like, let's just enjoy today and be together and just chill out. And it's the most freeing, awesome way to do life when, and I have people that I know who are like, today, they would have been like, okay, I'm going to get up and go to the gym, and then I'm going to do this, and I'm going to have coffee with this person, then that, and then lunch, and then this, and then dinner, and then blah, and then I've got to check my emails, and da-da-da, and I'm like, oh, I actually have a headache from you just talking. Shut up. And none of those things, none of those things involved me, so I don't even care.
It's so funny. The way it's like, as you're talking then, I was just looking out at the trees and just smiling, grinning. Because it's like you're just describing such a beautiful way to live that makes you so happy, so peaceful, so content, so in harmony and really intelligent. Because it's to have that level of dexterity with choice and knowing you're right for, or, you know, good for bad, because there is like things that serve you and don't serve you, and living it out is fucking awesome.
It's so cool. You know, one other thing that I want to share, because this is a really kind of good little house rule that we have here. So when I first moved in with Glenn, who I'm now married to, but when we first started living together, I like his phone would ring like in the late afternoon. Like he'd get home from work around 3:30, quarter to four, because he's a tradie. And so we'd just chill out in the afternoons because I was doing breakfast radio at the time. And his phone would ring and I'd be like, do you want to get that? And he's like, no, my phone is for me to use, not for me to answer. I'll just call them back when I'm ready. And because he's so chilled out. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, that is so rude. I'm like, you're rude. That's so rude, not answering that call. He's like, no, that phone is not for everybody else's convenience. It used to drive me insane, Jez. I would be like, or a text message would come through and I would get off the couch and go to like the desk and get his phone and bring it back and give it to him. And I'm like, aren't you going to check that? Aren't you going to respond to that? And he's like, no, I'll just get back to them tomorrow. I'm like, oh my God. But what I really, and I love it now because that's like our house rule now, is like, phones, I don't even know where my phone usually is in the house because I don't care, because we do it on our agenda. And unless it's super, super urgent, like you cannot get in the way of us. Like our home is our sanctuary. And when we're connecting and we, you know, are here together, even a meal or whatever, like I don't want anyone interrupting that, because that's that fills us up as humans and makes us better. So when you bring all these distractions and no judgment, but the more screens in your house, the more opportunity you have to distract yourself from actually connecting with your family and with your children. And the family home is something that I think is getting destroyed, and we're trying to bring it back. You know, like we are doing our very, very best to have a genuine, authentic, engaging connection in this home. And it's like meals at the dinner table and grace beforehand and no TVs. And not that we don't have a TV. We're not that insane. I mean, like, no, there's no TV on in the background when we're eating.
I don't have a TV.
I figured that you were one of those.
insane boys.
You're probably close to living off the grid, Jez, which is my really secretly is what I would love to build a yurt somewhere and with my own hands and, like, live off the grid. But, you know, I feel also that...
No, you need integration.
Well, that wouldn't serve my purpose.
You're better at your phone stuff.
Yeah, that wouldn't serve my purpose. So escaping from the hundreds of people that I want to help is also not a great, that's not a great option either.
It's so funny that you go through this journey and then you have self-realization, then you want to help other people have self-realization. It's just a fascinating mechanic in the human species. And I wanted to just, the purpose stuff, like, so what was your process to finding your purpose?
Yeah, so I really have to, like, do a mad shout out to Simon Sinek, who I'm sure most people would be like, oh, who's that guy? But you would have definitely seen his TED Talk, What Inspires Great Leaders, and and he's done a few things since he put out this book, but the book that I read was called Start With Why, and it I don't necessarily think that I read that book and then went, oh, I know what my purpose is. I read that book and I went, oh, I need to find my purpose. So it articulated to me what I explained to you earlier, that for 12 years I worked in media, so that is what I did, and I was very, very good at it and I loved it, but I don't know why I did it. And now I know exactly why I'm here. So that shift, getting your why down pat first and then adding everything onto that, because I feel like once you get your why, I think I said this earlier, your what doesn't matter. So for me now, like, I know what my purpose is, and I'll get to how I actually got to the articulation of it in a sec, but now I know what my purpose is, it doesn't matter what opportunities come up, just so long as they go through that filter, they'll work for me. And if they don't get through that filter, then they don't work for me, and that's that. So it just actually makes decision making really easy. Because
how clear must life be?
It's just a relief. I'm like, oh, that does not align with my purpose. No, simple. Mm. And I don't feel bad, and I don't apologize ever. I never apologize. Even when I first stopped drinking, I made a point, because I used to feel bad about stuff all the time, but like not because I needed to feel bad. It was this really weird self thing that I did where I was constantly apologising. And so if somebody would ask me if I wanted a drink, I would just I wanted to say, no, I'm so sorry, I'm not drinking, like I'm letting them down. So I was really purposeful in going, no thanks, I'm good. Or, no thanks, I'll just have a water. And I had to really, like, train my brain to not do the apology thing. But how I drilled down to articulating my purpose is I journaled. And if you're not a journaler, I don't know what creative outlet you have, but you'll need to use whatever that gift is in you, I think, to find it. So for me, it was a lot of long walks in nature with no distraction, and a lot of thinking space, and then I would just journal, and I write every single day, sometimes physically, like in my journal with a pen, sometimes physically on my computer with my fingers, but either way, I have to get stuff out of me. And I really believe that there's a magic in when you have a thought and you marry it with a physical action, like there's some sort of chemistry that takes place there. And so so I would write and write and write in my journal, and then eventually, after probably a few months, I drilled it down, and I was like, okay, so I wrote about the things that fill me up, and then I realized they were the things that I thought filled me up, but they weren't. So then I had to go back and like redo that list. And I kept revising this list until I truly found what mattered to me. And it's funny because it's never your first draft. So it's never the headline. It's never the first thought that you have. Usually for that stuff, I don't think that's just what you convince yourself is important to you. But then you have to scratch that, delete that draft, and then go back. And then you keep doing that process of what lights me up, what is important, and why do I want to be here? That's the other thing, is a big part of it for me was, what do I want to do in my life? And for me, it's to help people. And so that is, you know, the embodiment of, I guess, the articulation of what I'm saying is, it really is to help people. And the way that I've articulated, I think, is like my flair on it, and how like the word empowering to me is so important. But in order to empower other people, you have to be empowered yourself. So I had to start with that. I had to be like, okay, I need to really live this. I have to live my purpose before it's going to be of value to anyone else. So for me, like, it really was just a lot of journaling and a lot of writing, and you know, that brings up emotional stuff as well. And I think it's great to do that work. Like, it's confronting, because you're like, man, I have so many issues, but at least I'm getting through them one at a time.
I love how jovial you were about that.
It's so true, though. I'm like, I'm beautifully complex, but I'm okay with that.
Man, what a journey. And it's such a continuum, right? Like, there's always new little things bubbling to the surface in our psyche.
I think that's the whole point of it, you know? Like, I'm a huge fan of moving forward and progress, and not at a silly rate, you know, and not to tick boxes anymore. Like, I don't do stuff now for other people's approval, but I pretty much did my whole career for that. And look where that ended. So it's such a redundant exercise. I think you've got to be, and there's such a difference as well between being self-aware and being obsessed with yourself. And I think, you know, our Instagram culture is really, really pushing that narrative of being obsessed with you. Like, look at me, I'm doing this thing. Look at me, I'm at the shops buying groceries. Like, who cares? But the self-awareness, so my level of self-awareness is I don't usually shop at the grocery store, I go to the farmer's markets, but I'm like, I'm at the farmer's markets buying groceries and no one else gives a shit about that, so I'm not going to put that on Instagram. That's the difference, you know?
So that's an interesting thing, just to go into socials for a moment, because I definitely know that trap and that energy in that realm. And so you feel like you've transcended that by a simple mechanic of going, does anyone else care about this?
That's my social media filter, pretty much. So social media is really tricky for me because I don't... I say that I have to have it, but only because, like, my Facebook page is attached to my two businesses. So I actually can't delete my Facebook page without deleting my business pages, and that's counterproductive. So, but I've just put, again, it's all about boundaries. So I've unfollowed everybody. This was a couple of years ago I did this. Like, I have unfollowed everyone on... So my news feed now is pretty much, like, really cool video recipes from this Facebook page called Goodful, TED Talks, Oprah's Soul Session TV. I think there's a bit of Deepak in there. Like, just stuff that is going to fill me up. And I don't actually follow any of my actual friends, so I don't know what's going on in their lives. But that's great, because then when we catch up and I'm like, hey, what's been going on? And my friend's like, didn't you know that I went to Europe? I'm like, no, you never told me. Tell me, how is Europe? And then you get to have a real conversation. I actually find it much better. And then similar with Instagram, like... Again, it is healthy boundaries, and I try not to put photos of myself on my Instagram. I use it more of a, hey, like, you know, there's this cool aerobics class that I'm doing on Friday night, and instead of having a photo of me doing the aerobics, it's like something aerobics related. Like, I try not to put too many photos of myself, because I don't know, it just seems so showy, and again, there's no point. I try to only share stuff that I genuinely think people would benefit from or that I want people to know about. And again, that's discipline. Like, that's really hard. It's hard to... I think, again, once you get out of the habit, though, probably a couple of years ago, I'd be like, ooh, that's a pretty sunrise. Ooh, let's take a photo. And now I'm like, oh, that's a pretty sunrise. I'm going to watch it until it's right up high in the sky.
So nice. You must feel so much more connected to yourself and others and your environment, hey?
Yeah, and I've just become a huge nature lover. I think I always was a nature lover. Like, I grew up doing bushwalks in the Blue Mountains with my family on, you know, like, weekends away and stuff. And I'm like, some of my favourite memories of being a teenager was, like, me, my mum and my dad would walk our Rottweiler, Keisha, around the block, and it was a 4K walk. And that's when I used to, like, just connect with my parents when they were together. And so that, you know, I think walking's always been a thing for me. And so just being able to get out of the house and walk. And I talk about that a lot in the 31 days. I'm like, just go and flap your wings in nature today, because that takes the edge off. That relaxes you. That makes you feel better.
Massively.
And there's no hangover. And you don't have to, like, it's free. there's so many reasons why going just for a walk in the outdoors is going to give you all of the natural benefits of what you think alcohol is probably going to give you, which it doesn't. You believe the lie that that you've been sold about that. So, and I also think, it sounds weird, but like we're from the earth, and so connecting back into the earth is, you know, a part of our duty.
That's so weird. That's such a weird idea.
Yeah, I feel some people will be like, you're such a weirdo, but I feel like when, so snowboarding's my favourite thing to do ever. And when I went to Canada at the end of last year for a month with my family on a holiday, and this happens every time I go to the snow, I got on that chairlift and it was minus 12 and I got to the top of that lift and I got off and I looked out and I burst out crying because I was so overwhelmed by how magnificent our nature and our world is. And so bringing that down to like a daily, you know, like living in this daily, it's stuff like, let's stop using plastic. And like, it's all these things of like, let's not trash our environment. Let's live lives where our footprint isn't damaging. You know, let's tread lightly on the earth. So when I say like we're from the earth, it's like this really holistic living that I do now, where it's not that I just don't drink alcohol. It's like I want to look after our planet, and it all intertwines really beautifully when you get the initial clarity that like we actually are here to we have to look after the place that we've been given, right? Otherwise,
yeah.
Like what are we doing? So
I was just gonna say it's actual insanity to not be in harmony with your environment. I mean, this fucking earth birthed us. We wouldn't be here without it. And to have that disconnect or non-embrace of it is in total insanity. So what you're saying is purely sane.
And when you are in nature more, you get a bigger revelation of that. And I'm getting a bigger and bigger revelation after doing this for a few years now. But every time I, you know, get down to the beach and put my feet in the ocean, or I'm walking through trees and listening to birds, I get this real sense of like, okay, I want to serve this place well because it's serving me right now. You know, it's here and it's beautiful and it's filling up my cup. So, that's I guess one of the benefits that I've not really actually considered until speaking to you about it of my alcohol-free journey as well, is just this amazing appreciation for the miracle that we get every day.
That's so wonderful. Isn't that something we need to wake up to every morning?
Every morning.
Beautiful. And what I think that's a beautiful place to wrap, because I feel like we could talk forever.
Oh, my gosh. We actually could probably do the world's longest podcast episode. Like, we'd go way longer than Joe Rogan. I think I listened to one of his podcasts and it was nearly 3 hours long. I can't remember who it was with and I couldn't stop. It was just, he's phenomenal.
Just quickly on the psychedelics, have you explored much of that stuff other than research?
No, I haven't. I only just got introduced to the whole idea on this podcast episode that I was listening to with Michael Pollan, and he's written a book about it, so I'm a bit of a Michael Pollan nerd. So I will probably get that book. But what they were talking about sounded very interesting to me, and I am very conservative in that regard. So,
I think he was a perfect candidate for it because he was so neutral and so journalistic about it that it needs that twist because it's such a powerful thing. And anyone that does it, you know, consciously at least, is like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. If only the world did this and there'll be no suffering. He's way more measured and way more considered and way more scientific. So I think it needs that voice.
I think I would believe anything Michael Pollan endorsed. Like, that's how credible he is to me. So the fact that he managed to broach a subject that I was like, cool, isn't that just like totally illegal and just not okay? And now I'm like, oh my God, this is actually really interesting research. I think that probably speaks for itself. But I don't know anything like personally. I don't have a story to share, but maybe I will in the future.
That'll be our next episode. Well, thanks so much, Maz. Massive love, and I love all the work you're doing and how powerful it is.
Thanks for your support. You're just a great person to chat to, and you're a good human. You've always been a good human, and I love that about you.
Hey, thank you so much. Lots of love.
See ya.